Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. This is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Sam Wong, founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. Welcome, everyone.
So we hear a lot about trade in the last few months, over the last year. And trade is usually discussed in terms of tariffs, in terms of competition often between the United States and China. But the nature of trade has been changing dramatically as well, in large part as a result of technology. Legal trade, illegal trade is certainly not what it used to be 40 or 50 years ago, let alone a decade ago. And one of the changes that we are dealing with as a nation and around the globe is how new technology disrupts all aspects of our life, but has also created new kinds of illicit trade that are having a profound effect on our economy and creating all sorts of new dangers that we need to deal with. And this ranges from issues related to sex trafficking to the sale of weapons. Our guest today is Louise Shelley, who is the Omer and Nancy Hurst Endowed Chair for Civic Intellectual, as well as a university professor in the Scar School of Policy and Government, and the founder of the Director of the Terrorism Transnational Crime and Corruption Center at George Mason University. Today we're going to talk about her most recent book, Dark Commerce: How a New Illicit Economy is Threatening Our Future, which is out with Princeton University Press. Welcome to our show.
My pleasure to be there.
So maybe we could just start with the basics. When you're talking about the illicit economy, what kinds of transactions, what kinds of commerce are you most interested in?
It's a very broad range. So it goes from things that we think about all the time as transnational crime, which is illicit drugs, illicit arms trade, illicit people, but it's much farther ranging than that. One of the things that is challenging us these days is illicit trade in pharmaceuticals, in illicit pesticides that destroy the earth, of overfishing, illegal timber. The list goes on and on in the virtual world. And then there's been an expansion in the last 10 or 15 years of new virtual products that are very harmful to us, malware, botnets, trojans, that are allowing criminals and sometimes state and non-state actors to steal our identities or our bank accounts.
And obviously, illicit trade and an illicit economy is something that certainly in the United States has always been a problem, and in all economies has always been there. How is it changing? Is it just changing in terms of the type of illicit activity that we see, or is the impact and the substance fundamentally different than anything we've experienced before?
I think it's an illicit trade on steroids. Up until 30 years ago, we had illicit trade that was based on personal relationships, currencies or gold, and dealt in tangible products. And the fact that people had to know each other, that they dealt with tangible goods, reduced the amount of trafficking of illicit commodities. But now, in cyberspace, where you can order illicit drugs from China just by, you know, clicking on your keyboard, and they will be delivered in 24 hours, you are having a rise in this phenomenon that is unprecedented, which has helped contribute to the death of, you know, over 50,000 Americans last year from the opioid epidemic, a lot of it, or most of it, from illicitly traded commodities. And we're finding an enormous decline in the natural resources on which our planet is dependent, which may be as threatening to us in the coming years as climate change.
Well, let's see. So, Louise Shelley, you talk in your book about what I would characterize as top-down forces, where the top-down forces are people who want products, say, you know, warlords or other lords of illicit commerce, or perhaps climate change, great forces like that. And I wanted to maybe drill just a little bit into one of those examples, the example being you have a whole chapter on rhinoceros horns, which so let me just back up a step here. So rhinoceros horns, pardon my asking these things. So what, people think they're an aphrodisiac or they fix cancer or something? Is that what they think rhino horns do?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, many people believe that they have curative values,
uh-huh.
and they certainly are a status symbol.
Great.
And consuming them is a status symbol in many post-communist states like China and Vietnam.
Okay, so there's a demand for these things, but in your chapter on rhino horns, you talk about how individuals who go hunting for rhino horns, if I understand correctly, they don't do it for a business. They live in South Africa. They don't have much money. They're in poverty. So there's huge inequality, and they step up because somebody, places an order for a rhino horn? I'm just trying to understand the big forces that drive people to engage in this kind of trade.
So there's demand in Asia, and then there's poverty and economic inequality in South Africa, and there's an absence of community development in the areas around the national parks, and so people do not identify their interests with preserving the animals, and they also think that they don't believe that there's a reason they should be illegal. Animals are for their use and for their benefit. And so there's a ready supply of poachers that can be bought and their services bought by crime groups that are local and transnational. And this leads to a problem that I call dysfunctional selection, where in the past animals survived based on their attributes for survival, but now it's dysfunctional. The more horn that you have, the healthier the animal that you are, the more likely you are to be killed.
So I guess the thing I'm wrapping my head around here is that at some level, people engaging in these kinds of activity are responding to forces around them. They're like fish going with the water. And so if you are an impoverished person in South Africa, there's something you just said, which is that they don't think that it's wrong to hunt these animals. But it's also the case that they are under conditions of privation. So in some sense, unfettered forces, just market forces, demand forces, and climate, things like climate change, where there may be, in some parts of the world, famine and so on. These seem to be forces that just drive people to do things that help them to adapt. So at some level, a lot of these people that you're describing who engage in this kind of activity are simply responding to market forces that are just let loose, where the market force is people like rhino horns, and so they're willing to pay, you know, whatever, thousands of dollars for some small quantity of rhino horn.
In part, it's market forces, but there are other places outside of South Africa where park development has been more coupled with the interests of the people living around the parks, which has not been done in South Africa, where there's also been a very high level of corruption in the individuals surrounding the parks, and therefore they've not been able to tie individuals' interests to an anti-poaching activity. In fact, the calculus of individuals is they gain more by killing than they do by preserving.
Okay, so let me go back. I'm sorry, I'm just really trying to wrap my head around the totality, because you've really engaged in a sweeping description of environmental degradation. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, it was sort of bothering me, is that there's an actor that shows up in this book that also has shown up elsewhere in the news, which is that of Deutsche Bank. So I want to hear you talk a little bit about the role of Deutsche Bank, which, you know, this large financial institution, in either allowing, you know, we're getting a little bit off of rhino horns a little bit, but just a large, legitimate financial institution in enabling illicit activity. So can we trace through exactly how that goes through the economy?
I mean, one of the things that we have to understand is that there are the small scale actors who are participating in this illicit activity for survival. But this is not just a part of crime groups. As I say, this month, the environment is not done just by criminal actors. And it takes the banking sector and it takes others to do this. And Deutsche Bank is one of the banks that's most involved in this, but is not the only one. Deutsche Bank is everywhere where I've been looking at large-scale illicit trade. One of the most interesting cases in which I found their involvement was in the carbon credit markets of Europe. So the Europeans set up a carbon credit exchange to try and address the problems of climate change. But unfortunately, they did not crime-proof this market that they established. And hackers were able to enter into the registries and steal and trade carbon credits and make large profits by doing tax manipulations on these carbon credits. So who was part of this feeding frenzy? There were criminals, there were terrorists, and there was also Deutsche Bank. And one of the groups that was prosecuted in this massive tax fraud was a group of officials of Deutsche Bank in Frankfurt, who could easily have done due diligence on this fraud because some of the illicit trading was going on within 5 minutes' walk of their office. But they didn't. And they were found by German law enforcement to be guilty. And for once, the German a corporate official went to, was convicted of this crime. Also, Deutsche Bank was deeply involved in what has been called the biggest environmental crime of our time by the former Prime Minister of the UK. Deutsche Bank loaned $600 million to the kleptocrat who ran Sarawak in Borneo. And this account and this money was used to help deforest one of the last great rainforests of the world, displacing local peoples, contributing to climate change, and allowing for large amounts of money to be accumulated by this kleptocrat, some of it which wound up in the United States, in Seattle, in the Lincoln Building, which provides and houses the headquarters of the FBI. So Deutsche Bank is involved in many activities that are helping worsen climate change on this planet and facilitate large-scale criminal activity.
It seems like a case of whatever is not forbidden is allowed. I mean, here, and you specifically say that this actions by this particular mafioso, Abdul Tayyip Mahmoud, resulted in destroying almost 80% of the rainforests of Sarawak in Malaysia, which is a pretty impressive amount of destruction.
Yes. And if you see, there's a wonderful film on it. It's just
The Borneo case.
The Borneo case. It is just total devastation.
So this is all very cheery. And I wanted to just kind of back up a little bit and say that I understand that you cited Julian's mom in your book. I'm curious about hearing about that just very briefly. It's a little human touch and an unexpected connection.
Oh, his mother wrote a wonderful book on money and the history of money. And what has happened today is that after 4,000 years of trade being based on currency and money and state involvement in the regulation of commerce, we now have cryptocurrencies that are a form of money, but very divorced from everything that we have known throughout our written history. And this has been extremely conducive to the rise of illicit trade.
But it seems like the trade has always been there, but it's just that the mechanisms have adapted to modern times. And so if we didn't have these mechanisms, wouldn't the trade still be there?
The trade would be there, but the trade has changed dramatically, because at first we only had trade in real products, Now we have a massive trade in these virtual products that are able to sabotage computer systems. And since so much of our lives and our financial dealings and our health are all housed in the cyber world, these virtual products have a way of accessing everything about our lives that was never possible before. So it's a fundamental change in what can be stolen and appropriated from people and from businesses.
Well, it's a curious hybrid because we have mechanisms in place to maintain financial security so that when money, which is sometimes notional, it just exists electronically, we have mechanisms in place to make sure that money that goes away from one place appears in another place, and we have these conventions where we agree to that. And yet we don't have mechanisms, say, to make sure that money is gained legitimately, and we make sure that it had a legitimate origin. And so all the technology, you know, say blockchain, has been put into making sure the money is the integrity of the money is maintained, but not the integrity of how it was obtained. And so it seems like there's a real deficit there in how we use financial technology.
There's an enormous deficit, and this enormous deficit is having enormous consequences for our daily life, but also for the sustainability of the planet.
So it seems the two ways in which this works, or two at least of the mechanisms for this illicit economy, one is cryptocurrency, which seems to be a method of payment that is very useful and difficult to trace. And what we often hear about, but I don't think anyone really has a good sense of what it is, the dark web, where a lot of this trade goes on. Can you first just explain to people what those are? And then, just as important, is it possible for either governments or some other kind of entity to actually regulate or monitor either of those two areas effectively?
Oh, these are very complex questions. But the latest stage of illicit trade, which I define three stages of illicit trade, is that which is going on in the dark web, which is the part beneath the world, where the inner workings of the World Wide Web. Well, the World Wide Web is open, and the dark net is the inner workings of the system. And within it goes on enormous amounts of illicit trade. Much of what is going on in the sites of the dark web is illicit. There you can hire hitmen and buy drugs and buy illegal kidneys and child pornography and many, many other activities. And the form of payment that many people are using in this are cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin is the most popular of these, but there are many others that are less responsible and widely used for illicit purchases. There are now exchanges being set up by reputable financial institutions that are trying to regulate this new area of cryptocurrencies. And there's hope that blockchain and other mechanisms may be used to try and more transparent. But at the moment, this system of cryptocurrencies and the dark web and the illicit products on it for sale, like malware and bot others, are just mushrooming whales in the billions of dollars in just one seller on the dark web. And it takes just enormous law enforcement resources to try and remove one of these traders. Like the first one was Silk Road, that was selling drugs and hitmen. And that was taken down after over a year's effort of law enforcement, to be shortly replaced by an even more potent seller of these goods. So this is an enormous challenge, because some of these illicit traders in the dark web are now affecting and reaching sellers in 190 countries. Many of them have no capacity to do analysis and counter crime that's going on in the cyber world.
Is there, I mean, is one method to combat this some kind of counter cyber warfare? I mean, by government entities, do they try to not just shut down these sites, but essentially screw them up? Is that part of what is done in an effort to stop them, or is that off, out of bounds?
I mean, there's some effort to shut these down, but this is not what is usually called cyber warfare. Cyber warfare is going after state-sponsored illicit activity. And some of these people, and many, or I should say many of these people operating in the dark web, are individual non-state actors. So some of them who are operating in the non-state world also provide service to the state. For example, Mr. Vinnick, who ran the largest Bitcoin exchange in the world, also is believed to have tied to the Russian government and was involved in some of the payment systems for the fake news that was used during our elections. So there's, I'd say, a fine line sometimes that exists between the criminals and the state, just as we saw with pirates and on the seas in centuries past. But it is not a form of warfare, and therefore we're not, our government and other governments are not going after it as a form of warfare. It is perceived as a form of criminality.
And we're almost out of time, but it seems to me that part of the question this raises, your book, and dealing with this issue, is just the nature of the internet itself. And you know, this is a discussion that's come up now with the election and the way social media was used or the way data has been sold and privacy questions that have emerged. There's all these debates about whether the internet, as it emerged in the 80s and 90s, somewhat the Wild West and very few restraints on what can happen, if that's really sustainable. And it seems that some of the basic character of the internet makes it extraordinarily susceptible to this form of commerce, and that without changing the basic model, it's going to be very hard ultimately to get out of this, because you're describing efforts to stop plug things only to see them reemerge in different forms very quickly.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. When the internet was developed and the World Wide Web, it was developed for a relatively small community, mostly of scientists, that was not built with inherent security concerns in mind. And what we have had now is a mushroom of this phenomenon that has and created, you know, new scaling of transnational crime. So that, for example, DARPA, that helped develop the internet, has been deeply involved for the last few years in developing tools to try and stop human trafficking that has just mushroomed because of the ability to communicate and buy and sell people easily. And research by DARPA was showing that $250 million a year was being spent to advertise people. So this is a major conundrum for us, a major policy issue of how much we regulate this existing cyber world. And to do so is costly. It's an investment of huge manpower, and it's a change in a philosophy of how this industry is structured. And one of the first efforts to regulate it came from Congress trying to make platforms responsible for what they're doing, online platforms in the area of human trafficking. And this was fought back by online providers as sort of the first wedge of trying to regulate them. But it passed because of the great concern in this country about the enormous rise of, you know, trafficking of young women, young men, and others. So we are on a course that is not easy to stop, not easy to change, and requires some very profound thinking of where technology lies and how it develops in the future.
Well, thank you. And thanks again to Louise Shelley. Once again, her new book is out, Dark Commerce, How a New Illicit Economy is Threatening Our Future, with Princeton University Press, available everywhere books are sold. Thanks again for joining our show.
Thank you.
And once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.